It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine?
Hey, everybody. How are you? Good, about half? Well, I'm glad you're half here then. I love it. I love it. Hey, I hope you have had a good week. We are in this teaching series. We've called it When God Moved in the Neighborhood, and we've been looking at the incarnation. We'll pick up where we left off last week in the first chapter of John, and we'll read just a little bit more. Here we go. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. Can you believe we are only 11 days to Christmas Eve? Isn't that crazy? I mean, I don't. It seems like every year we kind of build up and you get to November and Christmas is coming and then all of a sudden it's just, bam, it's right there. It's upon us. And so 11 days to Christmas Eve, and we have been looking at one word over these past few weeks, and that word is incarnation. The Latin word incarnate literally means to make flesh. We've been talking about what does it mean that God comes and lives among us, that he walks in our shoes, that he moves into our neighborhood. And we've said that in the ancient world, the idea of incarnation, not radically new. You might be walking to work one day, you might be walking in the marketplace, and all of a sudden Zeus or Athena or one of the gods of the Greek or Roman Empire shows up, has a quick conversation with you, and then bam, vanishes into thin air. So not entirely new, but what is entirely new and entirely like any other philosophical system or religious idea or way of belief is that this God doesn't just show up for a moment. This God doesn't look like a human being. This God becomes a human being. That right now, up in heaven, wherever heaven is, one of my good friends from Georgia said, "Heaven's up." Profound thought. That right now, Jesus is still very much a human person. Fully God, fully human. He didn't just kind of show up. He became a living, breathing, hurting, suffering, dying human being just like you and I. He's walked a mile in our shoes. He's moved into our neighborhood. Why does he do this? Because he loves us. Because he loves us, that's why. This radical love says, I will become what you are so you can become what I am. That's the love of Christ. And this radical love sets Jesus apart from every other philosophy or religious system in the world. And God's incarnation is so incredibly radical, we hear from John's gospel this morning, is that nobody even recognized him. I mean, picture this. For 500 years, the people are waiting for a Messiah to come. And religious scholars and the Pharisees and the scribes and anybody who's a devout Jewish person has studied all of the passages that lead to the coming of the Messiah. They know all about this. They know what to expect. They know about the titles that he'll have and the work that he's going to do. And yet this little baby shows up in this backwoods town called Bethlehem. I mean, not even a blip on the Roman Empire's map. And he's born in a cave. I mean, nobody even has a room for him at the inn. And it's not because the Holiday Inn was full. It's because Jesus is born to two poor teenage parents who would have been outcasts in the town when they showed up. And they said, yeah, we don't have anything for you, but there's a cave out in the back 40. Good luck. And so some grimy shepherds and three astrologers and some barnyard animals show up, and Jesus of Nazareth isn't even a blip on anybody religious or Roman, otherwise their radar. He doesn't exist. I mean, they expected power and they got weakness. They expected authority and they got humility. They expected a king and instead they got this. A nobody. A nobody born to nobodies. And I mean, this is Jesus all throughout his life. Who does Jesus hang out with? Fishermen. We're like, oh, but fishermen are nice people. They were roughnecks. They were the guys you find in the bars on Friday night, half in the bag. That's who Jesus hung out with. And Jesus hangs out with sinners and tax collectors, and he forgives the least and the lost and the unloved of society. Jesus forgives prostitutes of all things. I mean, these are the kinds of people that Jesus hang out with. And the amazing thing is, these are the kinds of people who all of the religiously devout, whether they're Pharisees or scribes or scholars or whatever, these are the people that keep the Messiah from coming. I mean, the Pharisees, they get a bad name, right? Like, oh, you're such a Pharisee. And we use it today to mean you're a hypocrite. But the Pharisees were some of the most religiously devout people of the day. I mean, these really weren't bad guys. They were more sincere in their faith than you would find in any culture or religion today. I mean, these are the people who knew two-thirds of the Bible, the Old Testament, the first two-thirds. They knew it backwards, forwards, and sideways. They knew the 613 commandments that God gave. And so what they did is they created a system called the tradition of the elders. The tradition of the elders helped you keep each one of those 613 laws. Let's say a law like honor the Sabbath and keep it holy, important law, right? One of the Ten Commandments. It's kind of up there. And so they would say, here's the way that you honor the Sabbath and keep it holy. If you want to honor the Sabbath and keep it holy, you only go a certain distance from your home. In fact, to this day, if you were to travel to Jerusalem, you'll see this wire that runs all throughout the streets of Jerusalem. And if you go more than two of the lengths of those wires, you've broken the Sabbath law. Still important today. They would say that to honor the Sabbath and keep it holy, you don't cook on the Sabbath day. Like, what do you do for football? Right? I mean, come on. They would say to honor the Sabbath and keep it holy, it doesn't matter how poor you are, if your animal, the one animal you have, ends up in the ditch, you have to let him lie there, because to help him out of that ditch would be to work. And that's not honoring the Sabbath and keeping it holy. And if your animal dies, well, must have been God's will. Surely we never say anything like that in our culture today. So they believed, brothers and sisters, that if for one day, all of the Jewish people in the world didn't sin, if they would just keep the tradition of the elders, the Messiah would come. And so this little baby shows up. One day he grows into a man, and he hangs out with the worst people in society. In fact, he breaks these laws or breaks their tradition, and they're mad at him all the time. Why? Because he's the one keeping the Messiah from coming. The Messiah is the one keeping the Messiah from coming. Do you see the irony here? Yeah. And they just thought, people, you just don't get it. If the Messiah comes, there's no more Romans, there's no more mortgages, there's no more taxes, there's finally peace. If you people would just get it together. Surely we don't say anything like that today, do we? If you would just... if you just followed my political ideology, if you just followed my religious ideology, if you just followed my ideas, the world would be a better place. And there's a fantastic meme with a beautiful little picture that we put on it in block letters, right? Surely that never happens today. John tells us this. He says, the true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. That word world is a big deal. See, John has two categories to talk about this creation. One is the Greek word for the world, the word earth, you know, this place that we live and stand on right now and relate to one another and live out our purpose or call in life, this sort of thing. And the other is this word world. A world is something completely different. In our culture today, when we talk about world, it's like, hey, we're going out in the world today, going to try to make our way. For John, world is a system that's completely opposite of what God intended. It's that the earth or this creation is under a control or power that is completely opposite of what God intended for it to be. For John, the world has to do with the authority and control of people that are in rebellion to God's desires for creation. See, the world is very much a product of our own selfish and sinful choices. There's God's intent we call creation, and then there's the world that we live in. We often call it my world or our world. And as we talked about 2 weeks ago, the problem is that we've made it my world or our world, because usually my world and our world screams out into culture, if you would just, then everything would be okay. No, it wouldn't. You just have a new problem, because it's your world and it's not God's world. And yet the beauty of it is, what does John say to us? One of the most famous passages in all the scripture, for God so loved the world. God even loves a broken world. God loves the brokenness of the people in it. He doesn't love that people are broken, but he loves broken people. So much so that he becomes like one of us. He walks in our shoes. He moves into our neighborhood and he says, hey, I will show you the depths of my love for you. Notice what happens, John tells us. He says, he was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. 500 years, people are waiting. They know all the scriptures. They've got a great tradition of laws to follow, just so he'll show up. And yet he shows up, and everybody, what? Continues on with business as usual. Because why? Where's Jesus? He's in a cave. And surely the Son of God can't be a baby. What? That's crazy. The light comes into the world and the world didn't recognize him. Why didn't the world recognize the light? Because so often we want to be the creator, don't we? If you just listen to me. And it's frustrating, isn't it? Because we're right. If my kids would just listen to me, right? Maybe. I think I know what's best for them. Sometimes they show me otherwise. You know, we all have these moments in our lives where we don't recognize the light, don't we? These moments where we would rather say, nah, I'll do it my way. I'd rather be in authority. I'd rather be in control. And in those moments, we find ourselves left in a set of circumstances or consequences in which we ask questions like, where did God go? Or where is God? Or why doesn't God come to our rescue? Or when will God be at work in my life? Because we know. We have this desire for an authentic creation with an authentic and loving God. And when we see the world and when we experience the world, we recognize that's not it. The world that's at odds with God. The world that says in our headlines, God doesn't care. The world that says God's not going to fix this. The world that says God doesn't even exist. The world that says God doesn't know any better. The world that says it's the religious people that create all the problems in the world. The world that says if you would just follow my ideology, everything would be fine and we'd have peace. 11 days to Christmas, and here's what I'm wondering. Are you recognizing Jesus at work in your life, at work in your neighborhood? How's he been at work in you? Let's take this opportunity. We'll dismiss our kids to Revolution Kids Church. Let's also invite our worship team to come on back forward. You brighten up the skies. A song will... And let's continue to worship this morning. So the creator comes into this creation, he moves into the neighborhood, he walks in our shoes, and the world doesn't even recognize him. Welcome to the world, Jesus. And what does he do? He gets to know them. And what you see all throughout the gospel accounts about Jesus is this light that confronts darkness. Jesus gets to know people who are living in darkness, and his great desire is to show them the light of God, to show them that God is very much present, God is very much aware, God is very much working. And so what does Jesus do? He heals people. He eats with people. He casts out demons. He teaches. All of these kinds of things are all about light that is confronting darkness. One of my favorite stories in John's gospel comes from John chapter 9. And in John chapter 9, Jesus encounters a man who is blind. In fact, the disciples and Jesus, they're walking along, and the disciples ask, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind from birth?" And Jesus totally flips it on him. He says, "Nobody sinned. The man was born blind so that the glory of God might be displayed in his life." And he goes on to say, "While I'm in the world, I am the light of the world." And the amazing thing is that by the standards of the religious system, this man, this blind man, was one of the folks who was keeping the Messiah from coming. It was his sin and his condition that was keeping the Messiah from coming. This man had broken the laws so often, so badly, that that's why he was blind. In fact, the disciples, they were a product of this world system. That's why they asked Jesus, "Who sinned?" And so what does Jesus do? He takes the stuff of creation, not the world, the stuff of creation, the dust of the earth, the same dust that God used in the very beginning in Genesis chapter 2 to form the man and the woman from the dust of the earth. And he takes this dust of the earth and he creates mud and he smears it on the man's eyes. What's he doing? He's recreating the man's eyes so the man can see. So the man isn't a product of the world system. The man is a product of God's creation. What's God's creation intent? What's the intent for our eyes? So that we could see the power of God at work. So we would know the power of God at work. So that we could see when God shows up in our very midst in flesh and blood, we could see his great love for us. And so he puts mud on the man's eyes and the man's eyes are opened. Well, the Pharisees can't have miracles. We can't have that. Why? Because it ruins power and control. So they invite the man to come before him, and immediately they call him a sinner, right? I mean, because that's like the ultimate trump card, sinner. You know, we know that you're a sinner. We know this Jesus, he's a sinner because he's the one keeping the Messiah from coming. If you people, it's always you people or those people. Have you ever noticed that? If you people could get it together, then everything would be fine. We'd have peace and this world wouldn't be a broken place. What's up with that? How is it that you can see? And he says, "I don't know. You know, the man must be. Do you want to become one of his disciples too?" And then they freak out. "Get out. You who were steeped in sin from your birth, get out." And what happens? The man can see. And the Pharisees are shown to be what? Blind. Blind to the power of God that's been at work in their neighborhood, at work in their midst, in flesh and blood. And brothers and sisters, that's what the true light does. It confronts our darkness, and it's uncomfortable. Why do people run for the darkness? Because sometimes the light hurts. And you look at yourself and you recognize it ain't supposed to be this way. And so rather than deal with it and deal with the warts and the hurts and whatever else it might be, we say, "Where is the darkness and how do I get there as fast as possible? Because I don't want anybody to know that I might not have everything under my own control or power." And the world has such a hard time with Jesus because of this. The world says, be a better person, run from those people, make good choices. Be in power, be in control, be the master of your own fate. God, we know better than you. Who do you think you are? And when Jesus comes and says, "You're in the darkness, here's the light, you don't have to earn it, just receive it." John says this morning, "He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, children not born of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God." Receive, you mean earn, right? No. You mean clean your act up first and then receive it? No. You mean get it together first and then receive it, right? No. You mean get it under control first and then do it, right? No. Just receive. I mean, it's completely opposite of everything that we hear every day. And it's so fascinating that for all the hopes and dreams of the world, and we sing those Christmas songs this time of year, right? The hopes and fears of the world. Yeah. Right? I mean, Jesus offers all of this, and we go, surely the answer can't be 2,000 years old. Come on, people. No way. I mean, it's almost like Jesus comes and says, hello, it's me you're looking for. And we hang up on him.
Hello, it's me you're looking for.
You know? Sorry, I had to. It's the most famous YouTube that's been out there in a while. I mean, it's almost like Jesus moves into the neighborhood and the world says, who are you to say what we need? You don't know better. We know better. You got to have a little comic relief. Come on. Who are we to receive something from you? Who are we to be reborn by you? Who are you to tell us what it is that we need? And Jesus has one of these encounters with somebody. In fact, with the religious upper crust of society in John chapter 3, his name is Nicodemus. I'd encourage you to read the story this week. With Nicodemus, Jesus meets with him at night. And it's a very important thing that John does in telling us this, because what he wants to show us is how in the dark Nicodemus is. So picture this. Here's a man, the upper crust of religious society, studied, well-learned, intelligent, a leader among leaders, in power, in authority, in control. And he says to him, which is a very nice lead-in, especially for somebody who's supposedly keeping the Messiah from coming. He says, Rabbi, acknowledging Jesus' authority, we can see that you have come from God, for no one could do the miracles or signs you're doing unless God were with him. And Jesus gives him the ultimate shutdown in your face. He says, I tell you the truth, no one can see the kingdom of God unless they've been born anew from above. In other words, dude, you're blind. You got nothing. Be sort of like, whoa. Right? And so they have this incredible conversation about how Jesus says you have to be born anew from above, and then you can see God's power and God's work, not only in your neighborhood, but in your own life. And at the end of the conversation, or at least the breaking point of the conversation, Nicodemus, this well-learned, inspired, godly, God-fearing kind of man, says, how can this be? What? How could I have missed it? How can you, this backwoods renegade rabbi, have totally stumped me? How could I have missed this? When the light shines in the darkness doesn't understand it. Sometimes the darkness doesn't want to receive him. Sometimes the darkness, quite frankly, can't even recognize him. And the reason, it's the end of our own worldly power, the end of our own worldly control, and the opportunity to receive the light of Christ. Well, how do we receive him? We recognize him as our own. We recognize him as our own. Who's in power or authority or control in your life? Is it you? Or is it Jesus? Who makes the decisions? Is it you? Or is it what Jesus says? Well, how do we do that? That's why you read the scriptures. That's why you pray. I mean, do you find yourself in a moment where you have to make a decision, whether a big one or a little one? I'm not talking about like, am I going to go to Thornton's or Shell for gas today? I'm talking about, you know, how am I going to interact with this person? Am I going to serve? Am I going to give? Do you find yourself praying and asking for his guidance? That'll tell you who or what is in control of your life. Because if you don't ask, how does he get a chance to be in control? Either we've completely vapor-locked you this morning, or God's at work. See, when we do surrender, notice the amazing thing in the passage is that Jesus says to receive first and then believe. In other words, you're not going to tie up all the tidy little reasons of why you should receive Christ. He says, just receive him and then believe. Give him a little opening and then you'll believe because of the work of God in your life. See, that's what faith is, right? We think, oh man, we got to come up with all the answers first. And then when we have all the answers and it's under whose control? My control. That's like, all right. I'll accept this set of logical propositions, Jesus. I believe you are the Messiah and the Son of God. No! We receive him, and the more we begin to receive him into our lives, the more we begin to believe he is who he said that he is. Why? Because no longer we're in control. Do you get it? I mean, if you want to see the power of God in your life, then recognize him as your own. So this week, I want my encouragement. Doesn't matter what I want. I don't want to screw up what God just did. Doesn't matter what I want. What I want to encourage you to think about, let's go that way. Does God have power and control in your life? Is he really Lord? And as we're 11 days from Christmas, I want you to think about a brother or sister who might be struggling or suffering or need the light of Christ in their life. You were given a ornament, paper ornament, when you walked in today. Don't write down names. Give a first initial of somebody that you're going to pray for this week that they would receive the light of Christ in their life. And take it one step further. Invite them to Christmas Eve, 5 and 7:30. Let's pray.